group in Charlottesville, James B.
Thank you, Dale. My name is James, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, James.
Billy, thank you for asking me to do this, and it really does feel like I'm talking to friends. It feels like I'm in somebody's house, so this is nice. So I'm going to talk to you in a general way, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now, and hopefully what I say will be helpful to somebody, and if you don't identify with me, there's a lot of people in AA that might be able to help you. You know, this is so where I'm at in my sobriety today. And I know things change and, you know, hopefully they're changing for the better and not for the worse. So my sobriety date is November 13th, 2005. And that's not the first time I came into AA. I'll talk a little bit about that. I first came in 1999. I was 24 years old. I had gotten arrested a couple of times back to back. And my lawyer told me it would be a good idea if I went to AA meetings and got a court paper signed. So that's how I first came to AA after burning my life to the ground and coming up zero in every area of my life. I showed up in 1999 and didn't have my last drink until 2005. And if you've got what I've got, you know, I don't need to tell you that things didn't get better in that time of coming in and out. It progressively gets worse. You know, for a guy like me, I'm drinking for oblivion, because the good times are gone, but my brain will always tell me that this time will be different. So anyway, I'm gonna start in this kind of start in the beginning, and I'm gonna go from there. I'm from Charlottesville. I was born there. I was born in '74. I grew up. You know, my dad was a house painter, and my mom was a teacher's aide. We grew up in a neighborhood and Charlottesville, and my mom was a little Italian lady from Queens, New York, that had moved here with her dad. He had taken a job. He was a tool and die maker, and his company had set up shop in Earliesville, Virginia, just down the road, and so he brought the whole family. And my dad was a country guy from Floyd County, Virginia, and my grandfather worked for Sperry Marine, and my mom was his secretary. So when my dad got out of the war in Vietnam, he came to Charlottesville, and my grandfather introduced them. And three months later, they were married, and you know, and I came along a few years after that. So you know, that's kind of how I came about. You know, kind of my family history, and you know, early on, you know, my childhood, I mean, it wasn't nothing too crazy. You know, I've heard people talk about, you know, stuff that would go on with them, but I was a happy kid. You know, I remember early on, you know, my mom would go to this, it was called the Italian America Club. And it was a bunch of people that got around and chain smoked cigarettes, and we'd have a blast. And my dad would get together with the guys, and they'd throw horseshoes, and everybody'd have cookouts, and it was a good time. You know, alcohol was kind of around, but I really didn't pay much attention to it. You know, I was, you know, out playing, running in the woods, riding bikes. You know, it was a good time to be growing up. You know, it was a lot of playing outside, and I remember, no matter what, you know, was going on, we just had to be home by 6 o'clock for dinner. You know, that was like kind of the thing, you know, just trying to get home for dinner. And I remember, you know, even early on, you know, my parents fought like crazy. They were kind of like oil and water. And my dad was a drinker, and you never really knew what you were going to get from him. Sometimes he was a happy, jovial guy. And other times, you know, you'd sit down for dinner and the table would go upside down, or, you know, a telemarketer would call. And for some reason, that would just set him off like a stick of dynamite. He'd take the phone off the hook sometimes. I remember him throwing the phone through the window, you know, as my mom had a cord on the phone that was about 15 feet long because she'd walk all around the kitchen when she was cooking. But anyway, that's so it was kind of a nerve wracking. And I remember, you know, I hated being there. You know, I was like a ball of nerves. I didn't want to be in that environment. And I had been around other people's houses and their family seemed like they had it together. You know, people seemed like they were calm, treating each other nice. And, you know, when I went home, it was World War III and I hated it, you know, and I wouldn't bring people over because I was embarrassed about, you know, what was going on. And, you know, we had the house, you know, that in the neighborhood, like, you know, and I've heard that like, you could be about 10 houses away and you can hear, you know, people fighting and you're like, ah, God, you know, what's going on over there, you know, getting out of there. But anyway, that's not what made me alcoholic. As I got a little bit older, I remember the first time I drank, you know, and I grew up, you know, knowing right from wrong and people telling me, you know, but I mean, it was just something, there was an allure to it. You know, I remember, we'd spend the night at a friend's house and we'd all get together and be like, well, what's this? You know, let's drink this. So we would mix a bunch of stuff together out of the liquor cabinet and the cream de menthe and vodka, you name it, and drink it out of stadium cups. And I remember the first time I got drunk, you know, and I had that phenomenon of craving that the book talks about from the very beginning. I remember the first time I got drunk, I drank to a blackout, you know, at age 13. And somewhere in between the time that stuff touched my lips and that blackout, magic happened. You know, that frightened person of the world and what was around them and what you're thinking about me. And am I good enough? Do I fit in? All that stuff just vanished. And I just felt like this was the best thing in the world. You know, it was like a spiritual awakening, you know, at age 13, you know, alcohol. And I loved it, you know, and, you know, I wouldn't become a daily drinker at age 13, but alcohol would be the biggest part of my life from then until, you know, age 31, when I came in here. So what would happen was, you know, I had really good friends, you know, guys in the neighborhood, people that had their heads screwed on straight. And then my drinking just slowly started progressing to the point where, you know, the people that were, you know, decent, you know, started to get away from me. And I was hanging out with the, you know, the drug crowd, the people that would, you know, in trouble, you know, older people that already left, high school, you know, and it was just broke my mom. I mean, they could see where I was going. You know, I was a bad kid. You know, I was getting brought home by the police even before I was 16 years old. And back then the cops would take you home. Now it's probably a different story, but I was a troublemaker, you know, vandalizing. There was a swimming pool down the road and we would, you know, sneak out in the middle of the night and just for fun, you know, throw the tires that had concrete for the volleyball nets. We would throw all those in the deep end for a present for them the next morning and break into the snack bar and steal stuff. So, you know, I was already getting down that spot and I managed to finish just about dead last in my high school senior class, you know, out of a class of 320 students, I was about 314, you know, I did absolutely nothing. You know, I'm one of those people when I start to drink, I can't drink and like do work or do school. I do one or the other and I quickly lose all ambition or, you know, drive to, you know, be a success or anything. You know, I'm just living to drink. So even at that, you know, my family, they saw where I was headed. And we didn't have much money. I mean, we weren't like completely broke, but we didn't have much money. So my dad borrowed money that he didn't have to put me into a year of postgraduate studies at a military school. I went to Fork Union, and what it was designed for was like for like gifted athletes to like that they couldn't get into a school, so they would go there and get their grades up to get into college. Well, I was not a gifted athlete. I was just somebody that had terrible grades. So I was in there, and I did well. You know, my grades came up. You know, I started getting a little bit, well, maybe I can do this. You know, maybe I'm maybe I can do this schoolwork. Maybe I'm not as stupid as I think I am. And so I started. Very structured. It was like kind of like it was an institution, basically, you know. But I mean, so I did well in there. But whenever I would go home for the weekends, you know, it was back to, you know, drinking like I like to drink, you know, and that's not, you know, having any sort of governor on how much I can drink. I just get dead drunk and do whatever I need to do to get the job done. And so I get out of that year there, and then I decided to go to military college. I felt like that was a good idea because I seemed to be doing well in that environment. And if you would have even asked me back then if I was alcoholic, I'd say yeah, but I didn't know what it meant. But I'd say yeah, you know, there's something wrong with me. You know, I mean, I'm not doing well. You know, when I'm drinking, I'm okay because I feel connected. I'm not full of fear. I'm not restless, irritable, and discontent. But when I'm sober, I just start drifting into this self-pity depression state where I just can't get along in the world. You know, I'm afraid of people. I can't seem to be any real use to anybody. I can't look people in the eye. I just feel less than, you know, I just feel like I don't know where I developed that. I just don't feel like I'm good enough, you know, and I compare my insides to your outsides. And I see people and I look at them and I'm like, well, why can't I be like that? Why can't I be like that? And plus I just live up here and it's just not good. And so I go to this military college and I do well. The first couple of years I'm doing really well. And, my mom, you know, bless her heart, you know, without her, I'd have been dead long ago, but she was so happy. My family was happy. They were like, you know, James is finally doing something, you know, because my sisters both did really well academically. And they were just like thrilled that I was doing well. And I did okay the first couple of years, but alcoholism it's progressive. It doesn't stand still. And what started happening to me was the stuff that I was doing while drunk, you know, the stuff that, you know, that I'm embarrassed about or that I'm ashamed of or that I do. And I'm like, I'm worried I'm going to go to jail. Like the stuff I'm doing while drunk is getting worse and worse. So the time that I'm trying to be sober is getting worse and worse. You know, sobriety is getting more and more uncomfortable. Where the durations of being drunk and sober are getting closer and closer, and the wheels start to fall off. You know, I can't keep it together. You know, and I go from a 2.9 GPA and I get a couple of back to back 0.0s in this school, and I get put on academic probation, and I'm basically just losing all ambition to do anything. You know, I'm in this school that, you know, everybody's getting ready to like be commissioned in like the military and everybody's like going places. And I'm knocking on somebody's door in the barracks at 2:30 in the morning, you know, getting crack from it. You know, I'm smoking crack in this place. So that's tells you about my mindset and like where I was headed at that point in my life. So I leave college and get a job working on a golf course outside of Charlottesville and get a little rent a room from a friend of mine over right on 29. And then my alcoholism just really kicks off. I don't have to keep it under check anymore. I can just drink like I want to. And it just progressively gets worse. You know, I'm doing stuff. I'm saying I'm only going to have a few beers, and then I wake up the next morning. I don't know where I'm at, trying to find where my truck is, and it gets bad. So I leave the golf course job, and a friend of mine gets me this job on this farm. It's a horse farm. And, you know, he had his apartment, and he was growing dope in it. And he gets me a job living in this other apartment. And 2 days into the job, the Jefferson Drug Enforcement raids the place. He gets arrested, and I get promoted to his job. So it was a job that, I mean, I was a farmhand on this place, and literally the biggest challenge for me was just getting to the shop in the morning to go to work. And the shop was literally from here to that exit door from where I was living. And that was a challenge. I would miss work at least one day a week. You know, I could hear everybody going off with the equipment, and I was just sick as a dog or hadn't been to bed that night, and just not doing well. I lived 20 minutes from my mom and dad, and in the 11 years that I worked there while I was drinking, they never once came to my house. I never once had them over. I was when I drink, I get real antisocial. You know, I might be, if you saw me out, you might be like, that guy's having a good, I mean, I'd be a lively rip roaring, but like when the door shuts, you know, I'm a antisocial, you know, a pathetic, lonely drunk, you know, I'm just drinking by myself. And that's how I got in this place. And anybody that had ever been close to me, I just started slowly pushing them out of my life. And the only people that I were hanging around were people that were drinking like I did, you know, or somebody that I was trying to get something from them. You know, I didn't really want to be around anybody. And the only, you know, at that job, you know, I, you know, really, it was bad. You know, I was, there was an old man there. He was like 80 some years old, and he would just go there and just sit in a chair because he was all broke up from age. And like my thing that would like really get me out of the door in the morning was like going to where his truck was and stealing his medications. You know, that was like what was getting me doing. And I would take that stuff during the day, and as soon as I got off, I'd start drinking, and I'd drink till I go to bed, and wake up the next day and start it over again. And at this point, I got all the accessories that go along with alcoholism. You know, I'm taking stuff to keep me up longer, stuff to knock the hangover off. I've got a couple of different doctors I'm going to that I'm describing to them how I feel, which is, you know, I'm just like a depressed mess. So they're giving me medications to take for that. They asked me if I'm drinking, and I say, oh, no, I'm not drinking. And I'm taking all this stuff, and my health is starting to get bad. You know, I weigh probably 175 pounds now. I was 220 pounds, you know, when I was probably 23, 24 years old. And I was beet red. You know, I was always sweating, you know, even if it was cold out, you know, I just wasn't looking good. And I'll just tell a couple of stories, and then I'll get sober. You know, I in this apartment that I lived in, there was a door that would go out into the barn, and I would get drunk and have to knock the pins out of the door because I would lose the key, and then I would be too drunk to put the door back on. So one night I like left it off and got up in the middle of the night, and I saw something looking at me, and a possum was in my house, and I got my compound bow and I shot it, you know, and the arrow went through the possum into the baseboard, and I just went right back to bed, you know. And it, the next morning I got up and it was still there, and I was just like, oh my God. And the house was a disaster. It was bad. And then so I get arrested going to town on a Sunday. I get a DUI, and then the result of that arrest, I got charged with assault on a police officer. And so, you know, I'm in trouble now. And this is when consequences start catching up to me. So, you know, I'm on good behavior. I go to court. I've got to do a tiny bit of jail time. I go to court and I get out. I'm good behavior. Well, like 4 months after that, I'm at a bar on the corner at the University of Virginia. And people have told me what happened. I don't even remember it. I was at this bar and the bartender cut me off and I threw my glass at him. And then the bouncer tackled me, nearly broke my leg. And the next morning I came to at the jail cell over there on Avon Street. I couldn't hardly stand up. My leg was so bruised. And I was just like, what's going on? You know, I can't. And I was supposed to be at work. And that the stuff we read in the book, you know, the Four Horsemen, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. You know, I know that, you know, from deep down in my soul, I know what it's like to be hopeless and just wishing for the end. Because at that point in my life, I wanted to die. I really did. You know, I would think about suicide a lot. You know, I'd be like, you know, I just can't keep living this way. You know, I can't see any hope or any way my life can get better. And only thing I got left is drinking, and that's killing me. And I didn't think there was anything else out there besides that. And so I get that second charge, and now I'm going to jail, and it's a little bit more serious. So my lawyer was telling me, he's like, James, it's a good idea if you go to AA to get your court paper signed. The judge will, you know, look favorably upon you. So I was like, you know, well, that's great. You know, I'll start going to AA. And I showed up to AA, and, you know, I was young. I was a punk, you know, I was a disruptive newcomer. I would come late. I would leave early. If I did share, I would drop the F-bomb about a half a dozen times. And then I was liable to just get up after that and leave the meeting. I was very disruptive in meetings. I got a sponsor, but in name only, you know, that very early on. I got a guy, he's still a friend. He's a friend of mine today in AA. He's a solid AA member, but, you know, I wasn't willing to do it. You know, I wasn't ready to go all in the program. What really was holding me back was this feeling. I was like, you just don't get it. My case is different. You know, I'm different. You know, I would come out. I'm like, I'm young. I've got this major depression. I'm broke. You know, I've got all this potential. Any way I could think of, I was different. And for me, the number one thing was I was using my emotional state to separate me from you, which is nuts because, you know, untreated alcoholism is an emotional mess. You know, I mean, I'm prey to misery, depression, can't seem to be of real use. I can't make a living, my job, you know, all that stuff. And so what happened to me was, like it's talked about, you know, half measures availed us nothing. You know, I barely did half of AA and I got nothing. You know, I stayed drunk. You know, I would leave meetings and stop and get beer on the way home. And sometimes when I was in the meeting, I was planning on doing it and I was, you know, eager to do that. And other times, I didn't want to drink, but I would still stop on the way home. And it was just getting bad. And you would usually see me in AA meetings on like a Tuesday or a Wednesday after a bad weekend binge. And what would happen was I was mainly coming to the meetings because I was scared to be alone. I was scared, you know, how depressed and lonely I was. I was thinking about taking my own life, you know, but I was just like, God, I can't do this anymore. But when I would come to the meetings, I would get a little relief. I would get just a little bit of, you know, just the fellowship and, you know, well, maybe there's something. And I, you know, would get that. But by Thursday or Friday, you know, I started to feel a little bit better. I was like, you know, well, maybe I'm making too big of a deal out of this all. You know what? I think I'll have a drink. You know, I think I'm going to get drunk. You know, I mean, I'll do that AA stuff if it gets real bad. And, you know, I always thought I was changing my mind, but that's the insanity of alcohol. You know, if without the steps and a God in my life, my brain will put me in that spot, whether I like it or not. You know, that's just where I'm going to get. And so, what happened to me was just coming in and out, and I won't bore you to death with the details, but, you know, in that time, in that 7 years, I was in psychiatric hospitals. I was in jail. I took every medication you could and probably not every medication, but I took a lot of them. I started having seizures. I OD'd. Had gotten thrown off of the farm that I was at, and I was back living at home with my mom and dad, and that they were crazy. And like my life was about bankrupt. And so I started like drifting out of AA meetings, when I say drift out of AA, I started going to meetings outside of Charlottesville, because I thought that was the problem. I'm like, the meetings around here, I'm just going to go somewhere else because I'm embarrassed, I'm ashamed. And so I started coming to meetings in Madison. And I met my sponsor, Billy. And so I got here and I got around a group, an active group of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, Sam, Mike, you know, Mike W, you know, a lot of people that were in sponsorship, guys that, you know, had worked the steps, were trying to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffered. And they took me in. You know, the group took me in, and a group of alcoholics that are enthusiastic about sobriety that all carry the same message brought me a stronger message than any one alcoholic could bring me, because what it was is I couldn't find a way out. I couldn't find somebody saying, no, you don't need to do that crap. You know, just, you know, do take what you want and leave the rest, you know, but everybody was doing the same stuff. And I got a job here making coffee, and that was something that I had never done before, and that really helped. But I'll go back to like my last drink. You know, I drank after I had gotten Billy to be my sponsor. I still drank a few more times after that. I was in an Outback Steakhouse in Charlottesville, and I was in a blackout, and a guy with a bunch of rings split my head wide open in a blackout. And I don't remember it, but people told me I had my shirt off. I had blood coming down my forehead, and I was screaming like Ric Flair in the middle of this steakhouse on a Sunday, you know? And so I remember like the day or two after that, I go to Billy, and I got like a 2-inch by 4-inch Band-Aid on my forehead, and it's got like ooze coming out of it. And I'm like, you know, I can't live like this anymore. And he said, you know, James, I don't think things have gotten bad enough for you yet. And when he told me that, I felt like somebody had slammed the coffin to hell on me. I'm like, it hadn't gotten bad enough for me yet. I mean, how bad do things got to get, you know? And it, you know, in that state, I drank a couple more times after that. And then my last drink didn't even register in the top, you know, 10,000 bad moments in my life. You know, it was just a pathetic drunk. You know, I was at a bar, which was very rare for me at the end of my drinking, because I was really antisocial. I was at a bar, and I could see myself in the mirror, and I was throwing them back, and I wasn't getting the effect like I normally would get. And I was looking at myself in the mirror, and I thought to myself, I said, I can keep pushing it and get to that spot of blackout, but that's all I have left. You know, it'll never be like it was when I was a teenager. It'll never be fun. It'll never seem fun like that. Now I'm pathetic. I'm about to be homeless, jobless, and this is all I got left. And I had a moment of clarity. You know, I had that moment of clarity that is talked about in the that I hear people talk about. And the next morning I woke up and, you know, I was willing to do absolutely anything to not take another drink. You know, I had that gift of desperation. So I went to a treatment center, which for me at that time was like the last thing I wanted to do, because I had been to treatment centers and I had drank like after getting out of them for like a day or two. But I went to the treatment center and I went to the meetings, but I was calling my sponsor every day. I had started working in inventory and I was getting active. And the big thing that the treatment center, what helped me the most in there was everybody, like when you have the group therapy sessions or whatever it is, they were like saying like, so what are you going to do when you get out of here to not drink? And everybody had a plan. Everybody was like, well, I'm just going to go to work every day. I'm just going to spend time with my girlfriend and I'm just not going to do that stuff. And when it got to me, I was like, I've got no plans. I've got no original idea of what I'm going to do with my life. I'm just going to do whatever my sponsor asked me to do. And I'm going to dive headfirst into AA and just do it. And as bad as my life was at that moment, I just felt an incredible sense of peace and calm about the whole thing. It was just like, I was done fighting. I was totally surrendered. You know, I was like, if I get thrown out of my house, if I do lose my job, so what? You know, I mean, I don't care. I just want to get to a meeting. I just want help. And so slowly, and when I got out of there, I just dove headfirst into AA. You know, when I was meeting with my sponsor, when it said to pray, we would pray, and when it said to write, we would write. And we started going through the steps. And yeah, I've worked the steps. I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of taking these things. And I've got a God of my understanding. You know, I don't have the obsession to drink alcohol today, which is a total gift. Everybody had talked about, you know, the big steps for like the fourth and the fifth step. Well, I had done plenty of those in my times coming in and out of AA. The ones that I'd never touched and that really scared me the most were steps 8 and 9, you know, going back and making amends, you know, the vandalism, the theft, the people I hated, because I don't know about you, but, you know, early on, resentments just about killed me. I had a boss that, you know, I hated that guy with the passion. You know, I mean, I hated that man, you know, and he, by all accounts, should have fired me and gotten rid of me, because, I mean, I was a terrible employee. But I remember the type of person that I was when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated this guy because, I mean, I thought he was like, if he would just leave me alone, if he went over, like, he's trying to get me fired, he belittles me. I mean, you know, that whole column, you know, where I thought he had wronged me. And I remember in the mornings, like when he would get to work, he had a condition. It was called a spinal stenosis, and he had it pretty bad to where he was dragging one of his legs. And he was really self-conscious about it. And so me being the saint I am, I would stand at the shop door every morning and just watch him walk. And it brought me relief to see this guy suffering on his way into the shop. And then the rest of the time I treated him with silent scorn. I just let my body language let him know that I hated him, you know, and, now looking back, you know, and after disregarding him entirely, where had I been at fault? You know, I was showing up late. I put his job at risk. I caused trouble for him and his family because he couldn't go on vacation. I was a terrible employee. I was, my body language treated him like, I mean, the list goes on, but you know, that's where I needed a sponsor to help me with these steps, because as far as I could usually get was what you had done to me. And that was all I could see. And the dad that I hated, you know, I made amends to him, and he changed right before my eyes. You know, I never hated my dad after that moment. We became friends, and up until the day he died, we were close. You know, we had no unfinished business. You know, and he did the best job he could. He was a good dad. You know, if I'd have had a kid when I was drinking, I'm hooked. You know, it would have been worse. Trust me. You know, so I'm so thankful that I got nudged in that direction. And you know, I didn't blow through these steps, and I didn't just do all this stuff like a rocket ship. You know, I slowed down when I was making amends. I stalled. You know, there was one guy. It took me 2 years to finally become willing to make amends to him. And when I did make amends to him, it was just like, why didn't I do this sooner? You know, and it was like, he was an enemy. And so that was a tough one, but I'm so glad I did it. And to this day, when I see him, it's like, I'm not going to go have coffee or lunch with him, but I mean, we can have a civil conversation. But my dad, I remember just getting him aside, and I said, "Hey, Dad, you know, do you got a minute?" And I was like, "You know, when I was coming up, I got brought home by the cops a lot. You know, I would go out and wouldn't come home at night. I know that caused a lot of stress on you and Mom. You borrowed money you didn't have to put me in school, and I quit. You know, I walked out on it. You know, I caused the family embarrassment. I treated you like crap, and I shut you out of my life. You know, what else have I done that's that I'm unaware of that's hurt you? I'm willing to do anything to make it right." And he just like let out an exhale, and he was just, I mean, it just melted away. I mean, all those years of just hate and just all that. And, you know, it's like I've got to be willing to do whatever it takes in this fellowship. When I read stuff in AA, like half measures avail me nothing, or if, you know, if I don't do this stuff, I'm headed to trouble. I know that for a fact. You know, I can still be like that today. You know, my behavior, you know, I'm not the poster child for Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, if you've gotten around me some days, you'd be like, "Whoa, you know, you take a drink, buddy. You're half crazy." And my wife would like sometimes my wife would be like, "I don't even know why you go to those meetings. It doesn't do anything for you." But like, there's other times she doesn't know. I mean, obviously she's very thankful I'm in this fellowship. And that's another thing. Before AA, I couldn't, you know, be in a relationship longer than, you know, 2 or 3 months. And it was sick at that, you know, and I'm coming up on 5 years of marriage. Next week, I've gotten promotion after promotion at my job. They trust me with anything and everything. I've got no unfinished business with my family. You know, both my sisters, my cousins, you know, everybody. It's just like I've righted that wrong. You know, that college that I went to that I hated, you know, and I was ashamed that I quit. You know, I've donated money to that institution to pay back stuff that I had stolen. And now when I get the alumni review letter, I read it. You know, before I used to throw it away. Now I read it and I'm interested. You know, I'm not ashamed of myself. And I truly today, thanks to you people, I have a purpose in my life. And that's something I never had before. You know, my purpose had always been myself, you know, and you know, what I was going to get and what you could do for me And if I was showing any interest towards you, you better believe that you had something I wanted. But now, you know, I love this fellowship. You know, getting around you is the highlight of my life. You know, no matter what I've got going on, going to a meeting, I always feel better afterwards. Like when I'm driving home tonight, I'm going to feel like I'm on cloud nine. Tomorrow might be another story, but you know, I'll deal with tomorrow when it gets here. But you know, tonight I'm in AA, and I woke up this morning and right when my eyes cracked open, the first thing I did was say, "Hey God, please direct my thinking. You know, please let it be divorced from selfish self-pity and dishonest actions. You know, guide my actions, you know." And today I prayed, you know, I said, "God, help me tonight, you know, help what I say be of use to somebody else, you know." And like in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, you know, I don't feel like I've got anything to give, you know, but I'm just praying to ask God to, you know, help me suit up and show up and just to talk about what happened to me and what I'm trying to do. And yeah, it's a good life, you know. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I'm still an active member of a home group. I'm a member of the Common Solution. I have a job in that home group. I sponsor guys. I actively try to make myself available to people. You know, I try to be of service. You know, I've always heard that in AA, you know, be of service, and I always thought that meant like just being a GSR or something. But I have come to understand service as anything, any action I take that'll be helpful to another person inside of AA. It could be setting a chair up. It could be sticking my hand out before the meeting. It could be making coffee, making a phone call. Yes, sponsorship. But, you know, there's so many things that go into service. And I try not to bring outside stuff in. You know, they talk about that three-sided triangle or the three legacy program of unity, service, and recovery. I try to practice that stuff. You know, I don't try to talk about outside issues that, you know, are will make people run from me. You know, I go to a meeting on Thursday nights. No, not Thursday nights. It's Tuesday nights. Thursday nights, my home group. Tuesday nights, I go to a meeting, and hopefully I don't say anything out of line. But like, well, when you get to that meeting, it's just like everybody's got like Hillary stickers on their car and like all this, and they're talking about politics for the meeting. And if you're on board with that stuff, you feel like you're in heaven. But if you don't agree with that, you'll be like, man, where the hell am I? And I don't say nothing. I just sit there and shut up and sit down, and I don't try to straighten anybody out. I just try to share my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I try not to bring anything outside, because, you know, this is kind of a fractured time in society. You know, people fight about anything, and it's a lot of stuff that trickles into AA, and I just can't let that. You know, I don't want to ever feel unwelcome in the place that saved my life, and I don't want anybody else to feel unwelcome when they come here, because, you know, it's real easy. It was, especially early on, it's just so easy. It was so easy for me to just find that one thing to say, I'm not like you people, you know, I don't believe in that, or I don't do that, and I'm see you later, I'm gone. You know, I don't want anybody to feel like that in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So 6:47, that's pretty late. I don't have much, I'm not a big talker, but anyway, thank you all so much. I got a lot of respect for this group and the people in here. Y'all have helped me a lot. So thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Curtis. I'm alcoholic. Thank you, James. We appreciate you coming and such an open, honest AA talk. I, for one, got a lot out of it.